Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. Without putting too fine a point on it, tomorrow is the beginning of the end. That was a little Federal Reserve joke right there, folks. I'll be here all week. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you along, everybody. It's Tuesday, the 19th of September today. For almost a decade, the Federal Reserve has been backstopping the American economy with its $4 trillion pile of bonds and mortgage-backed securities that it bought up during and after the financial crisis. The idea, as you heard here and elsewhere, was to keep borrowing costs low and, if you remember your macroeconomics course, goose the whole economy in so doing. It's widely expected, mostly because Dr. Yellen has been telling us that the Fed is going to start unwinding its balance sheet tomorrow, letting, just a little bit, the economy work more normally. So what is going to happen when that happens for the first time in a decade? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
The Fed's been pushing its thumb on the scales for years, driving up the price of bonds and yields down. Theoretically, if the Fed just took its thumb off the scales, yields would bounce up.
And if Treasury bond yields go higher, so will private sector borrowing costs, perhaps the most important being mortgage yields.
That's John Lonsky with Moody's Analytics. Back in 2013, when the Fed somewhat clumsily announced an earlier stage of this plan, markets were surprised and confused and alarmed, and yield prices did shoot up. This time?
I don't think it's going to happen.
In fact, just about nobody does. Arvind Krishnamurthy teaches at Stanford's Business School.
This is about communication.
The Fed has been telling everyone repeatedly for months now it would get around to doing this. Exactly 0% of investors should be surprised. Plus, the Fed is going to move very slowly and modestly. Seth Carpenter worked at the Fed for 15 years and is now chief U.S. economist at UBS.
They are not going to come anywhere close to selling back as many bonds to the market as they bought.
The Fed isn't going to get rid of all of its bonds and securities. It wants to still have some on hand. All of this said, despite all the reasons why nothing should go wrong,
this has never been done before.
What if reducing the Fed's stockpile of bonds and securities changes the behavior of banks or investors in some unforeseen way?
Sort of like the old explorer maps from the 1500s were along the margins of the unknown territory and said, there might be dragons here.
Maybe, but dragons aren't keeping too many people up at night. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Remember we told you yesterday there's a new healthcare bill wending its way to a vote in Congress probably next week? Still wending. That's the update. All of it. There is some big economic/investment news today out of Norway. Yes, Norway, population a bit over 5 million people. As of today, according to the Norwegian Central Bank, that country's sovereign wealth fund has $1 trillion in it. That's more than 2.5 times Norway's entire GDP, or put another way, about $188,000 for every man, woman, and child in the place. It's the biggest fund of its kind. It holds stocks and bonds and real estate from all over the world. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more now on how it got so big and what that means.
So where did Norway get all this money? Oil, lots of it. Decades of profits from North Sea oil and natural gas. Rachel Ziemba is managing director of research at Robini Global Economics.
More than 20 years ago, they created a fund because they knew that one day they wouldn't have this oil wealth and they wanted to turn it into financial wealth.
With the high price of oil over the years, the fund's grown faster than expected. Some money went to infrastructure and other projects. Norway's government decides whether or what to spend it on. And so, says Anders Oslund of the Atlantic Council,
it is discussed a lot in politics, and a Norwegian election campaign is normally what should we do with our massive pension fund.
Outside Norway, the fund has clout too because it's so well, huge. It controls about 1% of all listed stock in the world. Companies like Apple and Google parent Alphabet. Ted Truman of the Peterson Institute for International Economics says Norwegians are activist investors.
They lay down standards about the things that they will not invest in, like munitions manufacturers and tobacco firms.
They also demand things like more women on corporate boards and promote environmental responsibility and greater corporate transparency. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
President Trump spoke at the United Nations this morning, the geopolitical details of which you will hear and read about elsewhere. I will note just for the record that not for the first time, while making a controversial set of remarks, the president led with the economy, specifically the stock market, being at a record high. Conscience dictates that it be mentioned here. Markets go down as well. On Wall Street today, records, just like the man said, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a new study out from researchers at Yale University which suggests, or basically just says, that Americans, white Americans mostly, are just out of touch with how economically unequal this country is. Tracy Jan had the story in the Washington Post. Tracy, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
What, in a nutshell, did this Yale study find?
The researchers found that Americans, especially wealthy white Americans, greatly overestimate how much progress the country has made towards racial economic equality. Basically, people think that Black Americans are making a lot more, have accumulated a lot more household wealth than they actually have.
We should say here that there was census data out like last week, you point out in this piece,
right,
showing that African Americans are the only racial group still making less than they did in the year 2000.
That's correct. And for every $100 of wealth that a white family has accumulated, a Black family has only $5 and a few cents. Hmm. And the same gap has existed for 50 years.
Right. How clueless are we? And I get that that's a rough way to put it, but how delusional are we, is the way you put it in the study, in the piece, about this gap?
We are delusional, and they studied white and Black Americans at the bottom and upper end of the income spectrum, so people making below $40,000 as well as above $100,000. And across the board, everyone's clueless. But the most delusional are the wealthy white people. And there are different reasons for this. They mostly point to psychological and structural reasons, psychological being that Americans who most buy into this ideology that our country has about us being a meritocracy, that society is fair and equal, those are the people who are most likely to overestimate how much progress has been made.
What's the rationale for doing this study? Why do we need to know this other than to know ourselves, I suppose?
That's a really good point. I mean, broadly speaking, you can't fix a problem that you don't know you have. And since the data shows there are huge racial gaps in economic equity, it's a huge problem. But because people don't see it and they don't think about it, policymakers are not viewing policy through correcting that inequality.
Yeah. It's worth a mention here, and one of the researchers you talked to points this out, race-based economic inequality is the founding economic principle of this country.
That's right. That's right.
And so here
we are. From slavery onwards.
Yeah, here we are 240-something years later, still trying to figure it out.
Right. So one quote that, you know, one of the researchers had that I loved was, she was talking about, you know, us growing up and hearing this story about an America that basically is like, oh, there was slavery, that was fixed. MLK marched, Martin Luther King marched, that was fixed. And then we had Obama as president, so all's good.
Tracy Jan at the Washington Post. Tracy, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
With Hurricane Maria beating another path of destruction across the Caribbean, it's reasonable to have insurance on the brain. Between Irma and Harvey, hundreds of thousands of homeowners, many of whom didn't have flood insurance, are already dealing with major damage. In Texas, less than 20% of homeowners in the hardest hit counties had coverage for flooding. That's according to FEMA. A little bit more than a year ago, Baton Rouge, Louisiana went through a similar thing. Rain by the foot swamped the area. Most homeowners weren't in official floodplains and so didn't have flood insurance, which has made recovery all the more difficult, as Marketplace's Ryan Kyloth reports.
1 year and 6 days ago, Lily Gum woke up to find her Baton Rouge home filling with water.
And within a matter of about maybe 30, 40 minutes, the water was just above my knees.
Gum flagged down a passing school bus and, along with her grandson, caught a ride to higher ground, then a shelter. She was shocked at the disaster. Her house wasn't in the floodplain. And because it wasn't, she didn't have flood insurance.
I initially went with a relative for about 3 days.
Then Gum moved in with a church friend, then another one. She stayed with seven different people before landing in a FEMA trailer park. It was weeks before she managed to check in on her home and start salvaging what she could.
A few times I just was too exhausted to even walk to the bus stop, so I put on a mask and I slept there in the house, and I ended up getting sick from the mold.
Gum says she wound up demoralized, depressed, and exhausted. Without flood coverage, she turned to government assistance.
There were television broadcasts that FEMA was offering emergency assistance, so I immediately applied for that, and of course I had to wait in line like everyone else.
3 months after the flood, FEMA gave her a $25,000 grant to start rebuilding, which she gave straight to a contractor, who she says did a terrible job.
My floors started buckling like a roller coaster. The base molding was coming apart. He basically just took the money and didn't do everything he said.
That money was gone. She cobbled together help, from free meals to construction advice, from at least five nonprofits. A retired truck driver on a fixed income, Lily Gum didn't qualify for a low-interest federal loan. Louisiana and Congress had promised to help people like her with no flood coverage, but there was no program in place to do it.
I'm Pat Forbes. I'm the executive director of the Louisiana Office of Community Development.
It was Forbes' job to create that program. His office directs Louisiana's federal disaster aid. More than 4 months after the flood, Congress approved $1.2 billion to make direct grants to homeowners. Forbes began setting up the program called Restore Louisiana.
It's not just cash. What they're getting is construction, reconstruction assistance. So we actually either send a contractor to their house to get it back to a decent place to live, or we can provide funding to them and their contractor who they choose.
The first step was to fill out a survey of your damage. Lily Gum was on top of it.
The day the survey hit, I believe I was up like maybe 1, 2 in the morning. I wanted to get in there as soon as I possibly could.
That was January, but Forbes says the first payments didn't go out till June, 10 months after the flood.
Yeah, it must have been around June 10, 50 days after the funds became available to us.
The delay was largely due to how long it takes the state and the feds to approve rules for spending recovery money. Lily Gum was one of the first to receive a check, and a state-provided contractor finished the repairs this summer. She moved back into her house last month.
I still have an air mattress that I'm sleeping on at my house. I just have to wait patiently until things come back to almost normal. It's not going to happen overnight.
Pat Forbes says government is getting more efficient at disaster recovery.
We started getting funds out faster in Louisiana than it's been done before, but I hope that Texas and Florida beat our record.
His advice to flood victims without flood insurance? Do as much as you can now with help from family, friends, or charity. Because while Congress will likely come through with a big recovery package, it won't happen fast. I'm Ryan Kyloth for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I tell women, we often treat our cars like our exes treated us.
Hey, now? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 39 points, about a 10% finish to 22,370. NASDAQ up 6, a 10%, 6,461. The S&P 500 up 2 points, about a 10%, 2,506. Toys R Us, the giant toy store chain, as you might have heard, has filed for bankruptcy protection, said it needs to restructure more than $5 billion in long-term debt. Thank you, private equity. Hasbro up 1.8% today. Rival Mattel climbed 1.2%. International tourism to the United States showed a big decline the first couple of months of this year compared to the year before. That's according to the U.S. Department of Commerce. American Airlines today off 2%. United Continental off 0.9%. Bond prices down. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.24% ahead of the Fed announcement on rates tomorrow. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. There was a little hiccup in home building last month. The Commerce Department reported this morning that what are called housing starts, just like it sounds, new residential construction, they fell last month. Second month in a row, not a huge deal, but another sign housing is not all that, big picture economy-wise. There are a lot of things going on with real estate, of course, one of which is that people who are carrying other big debts, student loans specifically, just can't afford to buy a house right now. But Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, the government-backed mortgage companies, are making some changes that might help. Sarah Weitz-Kotacek with Arkansas Public Media has more.
Kristen Griffin is a librarian at Nemo Vista High School in Center Ridge, Arkansas. She and her husband, Mark, are window shopping on Zillow while their two-year-old son sleeps nearby.
It has a huge front porch. I'm a front porch sitter.
They're looking at an older home with extra room for all the books she'd like to have space for someday.
I'm a librarian, and you don't see any books in here, do you? Because there's no room for any books. But this, it would be a beautiful library.
But together they have about $100,000 in student loan debt, mostly from her master's degree in library science. 2 years ago, they weren't able to pre-qualify for a loan, but their chances may be different now. Mortgage backers Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have new lending rules that would consider the couple's lower monthly student loan payments that they negotiated, so what they actually pay, instead of the maximum monthly payment they owe. The new rules also raise the total amount of debt the couple can have and still get a mortgage. Bill Worthington is a loan officer for the Bank of Little Rock. He's seen a lot of people carrying student debt come through his doors.
The debt's so high, and I mean, they just can't get a loan.
In fact, a recent survey by the National Association of Realtors and the group American Student Assistance shows about three-quarters of graduates say student loans are the reason they keep renting. But the new rules could make a difference in people's ability to borrow. Since the changes, Bill Worthington has approved several borrowers who couldn't have gotten loans before.
I think it is a good thing now because it is allowing people to get into homes that normally wouldn't, that would have to keep renting for a while.
While these changes only apply to conventional mortgage lending, he expects government-backed Fair Housing Administration loans are likely to follow. Betsy Mayo works for the Center for Consumer Advocacy. She says part of the challenge is it's taking people longer to pay off student loans than it used to, and borrowers are getting older.
Over half of all student loan borrowers are over 30 years old, and a third of them are over 40. So student loan debt is not a young person's problem anymore.
Griffin, the 36-year-old librarian, says she sees that in her own family.
When my parents were 35 years old, they were probably on their third home by then.
Griffin's husband, Mark, is a 29-year-old network analyst. He wants to get a home because he hopes his family will start building equity.
It's definitely, you know, at least to me personally, a sign of becoming a responsible adult and kind of moving on to that next level, I guess, the next chapter in your life, where you have major ownership in something.
But Mayo cautions that for some consumers, adding a long-term mortgage onto student debt isn't the best idea. While the Griffins have started looking at possible dream homes, they're still saving for a down payment. In Little Rock, I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek for Marketplace.
There are business ideas out there that once they're up and running, you're like, of course that was going to work. It just needed somebody who understood the market to make it happen. That gets us to Westchester Pike in Upper Darby, Pennsylvania, and the Girls Auto Clinic Repair Center. The mechanics are women. Most of the clientele is women. Patrice Banks is the woman behind it. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. We should say at the start that you have not always had a great relationship with your automobiles, yeah?
No, I was called myself an auto airhead. And I was. I was, you know, I feared the auto mechanic. I always felt taken advantage of. I waited to the last minute, you know, to do any maintenance or repairs. Anytime a dashboard light would come on, I'd kind of wish it would go away. And I always felt like I needed to ask a guy for help when it came to my car.
I should tell you that I do all of those things as well. You know, it starts making noise and you turn up the radio and everything's good, right? I want to back up for a second, though.
Yeah.
You were, in your prior professional life, you were an engineer at DuPont doing like technical stuff, right?
Yeah. I was a failure analyst. I tell people my job was kind of like CSI.
Oh.
So when you think about like when planes crash or like bridges collapse or buildings fall, failure analysts are the first people on site. They're gathering evidence to say, why did this happen and how do we prevent it from happening again? So it was a pretty, it sounds really cool.
Yeah, it does.
It's a lot of being in the lab and looking in microscopes, but I got to run my own lab. It was really cool.
So there you were, 30, whatever it was, years old. And what do you
31,
do?
Yeah.
31. You wound up going to like night auto mechanic school or something?
Yeah. So I actually never intended to go back to school to be a mechanic. I was looking for a female mechanic. You know, I had a great career with DuPont. I'm making six figures. I was writing a blog for women, teaching them things that typically men know how to do, or we have to pay a man to do. And as I was asking women what they would love to know that we have to pay a man to do or ask for help, they said overwhelmingly cars. And I thought, me too. I have problems with my car. Let me find a female mechanic and she'll help me write some blogs for women and help me learn. I could not find a female mechanic. So I thought, I'm going to go back to school and learn how to work on cars, because I knew that there was an opportunity to help women, to provide them with information that they need, and that that market was big.
You have, it's all female mechanics in your shop, right?
Yeah. We sometimes have a guy that comes and help us out. You know, we don't just hire women. We do hire men as well. But, you know, women are the number one customer in the automotive industry.
Well, yeah, right. They make make most of the buying decisions for cars and all that.
Yeah, and $200 billion a year we spend on buying and repairing our cars. And 77% believe that women are taken advantage of and mistreated. And so I thought it was really important that it just allows women to kind of let their guard down when they see another woman. They feel more trusting.
How's business?
Oh, man, you know, business is tremendous. So we've been open since January 1st, and we're already cash flow positive, which is great for a new business.
Yeah.
We've been getting a lot of press. You know, the concept is so cool, because I'm not sure if you know, there's a nail salon there, so you can get your nails done.
I had heard. I was going to get there. You beat me to it. That's smart,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, everybody thinks it's so cool. You know, and I got that idea because when I was working for DuPont, me and my girlfriend on our lunch break, we would go to this specific Jiffy Lube because there was a nail salon next to it.
Oh, wow.
And we would get our nails done and get our cars, our oil changed, right? So we loved it. And I thought this would be great. You know, we go out of our way to get our nails done. We will not go out of our way to get an oil change. So I thought, this is great. Killing two birds with one stone. Also being inspired, being empowered, seeing women, you know, women come and say, I've never seen a woman working on a car. They bring their kids. I'm getting a ton of, you know, requests to expand and start franchising.
Well, so are you gonna?
You're sitting on
a good idea here, right?
I think so. Yeah. You know, I get requests all the time. Come to LA when you come into, you know, Chicago, Atlanta. And I'm really excited. It's just a matter of time. And, you know, I'm telling people, hold on, I'm coming.
Yeah, well, there you
I'd love to be out there. My goal is to reach every woman driver. So, yeah, I'm excited to start expanding and growing, and starting with this book, I think, is going to help us get the word out there.
Well, so about this book, it's called The Girls Auto Clinic Glove Box Guide. It is literally a thing you put in your glove compartment. And there's honestly, and I've never said this before about a book I've done on Marketplace, there's all kinds of handy dandy usable information in here, as opposed to big economic theory stuff. What's the one thing that people get wrong about their cars that this book is going to answer?
One.
Pick one.
You know, I'd say the biggest mistake that we make with our car is just not fully understanding how to take care of it. I tell women, we often treat our cars like our exes treated us, right? What do you look for in a good relationship? Commitment, loyalty, someone that knows you very well. And we don't approach our cars in that way. We're in them every day. We don't know how to take care of them. We take care of our handbags better than we take care of our cars that are $20,000. So that's all this stuff is really great. It's in the book, and it's very relatable. It's not going to be something, it's fun. It's funny, and girls, it's going to make you laugh because
you're going to be able to think about your everyday experiences. And I know every woman has had one.
It totally works. Patrice Banks, she is the founder of what is, I think, going to be the Girls Auto Clinic empire. Their book is called The Glove Box Guide. Patrice, thanks a lot.
Thank you. I had fun talking to you.
This final note on the way out today, about which I am not entirely sure what to make, but here goes. Somebody in Geneva, Switzerland is cutting up 500 euro notes, almost 600 bucks at today's exchange rate, and flushing them down the toilet. A UBS branch office and three restaurants in Geneva said they had blockages in their pipes earlier this week. About $100,000 all told has been pulled out. The money was confiscated by police once plumbers did their thing. Quoting Swiss prosecutors here, there is no reason to believe it's dirty money, except, you know, that part. All right, we got to go. The Fed meets tomorrow, so today the markets wait. The Dow up 39 points, about a 10th percent. NASDAQ up 6 points, 10th percent. The S&P 500 up 2 points, 10th percent. Tommy Andres is the producer on our Special Projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.